Hey, this is Miss Melissa, the Bathtub Mermaid, and you are listening to Tales from the Tub. It's the Dog Days of Podcasting. It's Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015, and this is my interview with Nutas.
I am here with a woman with many IDs, and I'm going to have her introduce herself because I am too frightened to say her name on air.
Even though you had it right before we started.
Hi.
Well, yeah.
I am Nutas, a.k.a. Nutty, a.k.a. Nutty Nutas. Basically, as I was explaining to Melissa, Nutty is just a nickname for Nutras because Nutras is difficult for people to say. And more importantly, it was difficult for people to spell and type back in 1990s chat rooms, when your speed of typing was really important.
See, I cut my teeth on mushes, so I type really fast.
Oh, yeah. It was the same thing. That's how I learned. I never learned to touch type properly. Like, I didn't take keyboarding and I didn't take typing or any of those things. So I was a hunt and pecker. But because of the early 90s chats, I learned to type really fast. So I used to describe myself as a hunt and pecker gone mad. But actually, I'm now more a touch typer who just doesn't use their pinkies.
See, I touch type. I just don't touch type correctly.
Mm. It evolved from the hunt and pecking, and it just, because I had to be so quick, I just ended up being able to do it. And I think I rejoiced when I realized, hey, wait, I don't have to look at the keyboard.
It's so much easier.
So I can just look at someone and type. And to me, that's still amazing because when I was in school, I couldn't do that. I had to have my mom type all my papers because I had I just couldn't do it. And then I had the correct motivation that if I wasn't enough, I lost.
We were one of the first families among my friends, even though I'm 5 years older than you. Mm. We were one of the first families to actually have PCs.
Oh, yeah, me too. We had a Commodore 128.
Oh, wow.
I remember giving my pennies for that because all of the kids in the family contributed towards it. The rule was no games. And I remember my mom.
How long did that last?
I do know that we kept our copy of Bruce Lee and this other fantasy game and we hid them inside the OED. So my mom couldn't find them because if she ever found them, they got thrown away. And it was all educational stuff. You could have educational games like Sticky Bear Thump and Reader Rabbit and stuff like that, but nothing else. Oh, sorry. I don't know if you heard that, but that was my...
As long as you're not falling off anything, we're good.
No, it's just wires getting complicated. My U-Control just decided to fall off the table.
How rude.
So, so it was all educational games. So I remember trying to learn and my mom making me sit for hours working on Sticky Bear Thump and stuff and it just not clicking. Actually, the one game or program that worked really well for me was my brother for... One of his projects in university, he coded a program to teach me division. And so, I was young. I was, third grade, right? And so I'm learning division with this game. And if I got it right, he made the pixels do, little fireworks, It was amazing, right? And it was just, it was white on black. It was white text on a black screen. It was not fancy at all. And it was basic text. It wasn't even like different pixels making larger text. It was the tiniest corner of the screen, and it was great. And I learned the only drawback was because I learned on the program, I learned to do most of the division in my head. So mm-hmm. when it came to do long division, I couldn't do it. And it actually slowed me down and confused me. So
that makes sense.
They ended up sending me to summer school so I could show that I could do long division. I was, even though I was getting all the answers right.
That makes complete sense.
And it was so frustrating. I'm like, but I got the answer, but you can't show your work. But I got the answer.
I always hated the show your work thing. I find it the most tedious thing. As long as I get the answer. I mean, obviously, in that day and age, none of us had computing calculators because they didn't exist.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do they think we're doing? Just divining it from the air?
Well, I understand now from working with schools that the show your work is not so much about you getting the correct answer. It's about making sure that you're going through the right process to get the answer.
You understand the concepts yeah. instead of
intuitive. So you understand how it works so that when you get to larger sums, you're not going to be completely lost. Because if you miss out on a basic concept, you're going to be lost later, and your teacher's not going to be able to help you figure out what you're doing wrong. The problem is, for the way that my brain works, my form of ADD is that my brain just goes really, really fast. So my body is slow. And me writing it out ends up being such a distraction that I lose what I've done. So it's much more difficult for me to do long division.
I actually used to, when we had math tests or anything where there is a show your work step, and this was the same in English when we had to do outlines,
mm-hmm.
I would just do whatever I needed to do to get the answer first, and I would go back and do the work later
yep.
when there wasn't a time crunch.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Do outlines after I write the essay.
It definitely would frustrate people. They're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I got to figure out how I did this. So, and the funny thing is, much the same way, now I can't write by hand because writing by hand is so slow and I type so much faster.
I do the same thing.
If I write by hand, I get lost and distracted and I don't know what I'm trying to say.
I was just talking about this, I think, yesterday on my very quick, tiny, quick and dirty thing, or the day before. I write longhand only when there's a piece I have to write that needs to be written longhand because I need it to be slow.
Mm.
Because you have a different voice when you write on paper.
Yes.
So I use that as a tool. But back to you. What's a typical day for you? Because I know you have a lot of different activities.
It's funny because I don't really have a typical day. But I will try. Since I work from home, often a typical day for me is, you know, when I get up and get myself situated, I just walk across the hall into my studio /office. Where I record is where I do my work. It's where I paint. It's where I do everything, you know. It's all kind of here. And it's pretty great working at home for me. Again, as I said, because of my ADD, I can become hyper-focused. And sometimes I will lose track of the world around me. So I don't notice the passage of time until, say, my husband comes home from work and says, hi, you've been sitting there all day doing the same thing.
Do you forget to eat?
Yes, often, actually. Forgetting to eat is a very big, big thing. I remember
the worst thing you can do.
I know it is.
And I have the same
problem. I remember working in an office, and I would constantly be surprised when it was lunchtime. And so many people, they would go for, like, breaks and snacks and things throughout the day, and suddenly I was like, wait, it's lunch? What? Oh, I guess I should go and take lunch. And the joy for taking lunch at that point was reading time for me, which then baffled all of my coworkers.
Of course it did.
Because I would constantly get like, why are you reading? What are you doing? What's so interesting? Are you studying for something? No, it's a really good book. I get to read. Leave me alone. but yeah, no, I definitely will forget to eat. So depending on the day, there may be Aikido in the evening. There may be chiropractor lately. there may be podcasting. It's so hard to say that I've got a typical day. And then, of course, all of these things are constantly being broken up with. I'm traveling a lot. So, and by traveling, that's often going to New York and driving. Now it's only about 12 hours, so that's actually not bad. It used to be, you know, 18 to 26, depending on where I lived.
Wow. You better like to drive.
You know, I do. And it's one of those things that I've realized if I ever got a job where I had to drive, I would hate it and I'd never be able to take road trips.
That makes sense.
Because it would kill the joy. It really would.
That makes sense. That it makes complete sense.
And I drive manual transmission, so there's much more enjoyment when you drive manual transmission, I find, at least. For me, you feel more in touch with the car, so you really can enjoy it better, and then you can take those turns and curves a lot nicer.
So now I have this image of you, like, zooming down the Long Island Expressway.
Maybe. Possibly more the Southern State Parkway. There's less chance of getting caught there. But
fair point.
But you still have to be careful. You can't go that fast on Long Island. The top speed is 55, whereas there are parts of Maine where it's 70.
Texas is 70 because it's, you know, it's big and flat and there's nowhere to go.
Yep.
And it always, I think we actually just got one freeway that's now 75 during the day. Mm-hmm. Because here, they have like daytime and nighttime speeds and they're different.
Ah, I guess that's
true. But you're like 100 miles into Texas from New Mexico before they tell you what the speed limit is.
Well, I've got this new GPS, which is pretty cool, that it has the speed limit on the GPS.
See, that's useful.
Isn't that great?
Much better than guessing, because it's never the same in two states.
Yeah, the only time that it doesn't have it is if you're, like, on a really rural road that it just doesn't have that information on the GPS. But, yeah, it's all there. All the information's there. Garmin has learned to tap into it, so.
That's fantastic.
Love it.
Aside from driving, what's something that you, and podcasting and reading, what's something that sets your soul on fire?
Oh, that would be art. Absolutely. I am an artist first and foremost. When I was a kid, I was drawing. I always wanted to be an artist and was told that you can't make a living being an artist until I was in high school and then learned, oh, no, you can. they never said that it'd be a good living, but you can struggle and make your way through. I am definitely a starving artist, but I do graphic design as my day job, so I will do, like, currently I'm working on a print publication. Normally it's a 44-page publication, and I was able to get it down to 32 pages to save them some money in print costs. So I do a lot of layout. I do a lot of print stuff. I create websites. I do photography. I am a painter. Yes, I did your artwork a while ago. I've done quite a few podcast albums, album artwork, but not that many, because I am a strong proponent of, if you want the best work, there needs to be some money involved.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And I've had it happen to detriment that I just offer to do somebody's artwork and I do it for them. And then because I'm doing it free, they don't tell me, they don't give me good criticisms. They don't tell me what they really want and they don't ask for enough revisions. And then they're not happy with what they have. I'm not really happy, but I can't go any further without that input. And it ends up not being very good. Whereas, as you've experienced, when I did your art, there was a lot of back and forth. There was a lot of, well, can we change this? Can we add that? Can we do this? And then when you started podcasting, then I added on the extra stuff that you needed for it.
Yes, which is awesome.
I love it, actually. I think I prefer the podcast artwork, actually, to the blog artwork.
You know what? I actually do, too. And I need to ask you if you'll do one more version for me for my book blog where she's reading.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That should be.
Because then everything will match.
Yeah, that'll be great. We've been talking about doing a book blog artwork for a while.
And I couldn't figure out if I wanted it to match or not. No, I'm like, no, I love this mermaid so much.
Branding, baby. Branding.
Exactly.
You can make it everything.
This is why I have almost the same ID everywhere.
Yes. So having that kind of a back and forth is really important. And until you bring money into the equation, it doesn't really happen. People don't. And it has to be enough also. Like, you can't say, yeah, give me $5. No, they're still going to think of it as a favor. And you need some sort of a transaction to make that kind of creative process actually work. And so many times I've been disappointed and felt that I did a disservice. And I know that there's nothing that I could do because I wasn't getting the feedback. But at the same time, it just makes me sad. So the artwork that you see out there, Most of the time I have probably been paid for it or paid in other ways. I was paid in comics for the Sci-Fi Dig logo.
Oh, that's cool.
That one was a tricky one. I spent like months working on this one concept that I had. And when I finished it, I was like, I don't really like it. And then I drew this other thing really quick, did it in an hour, and I sent both to him. And he's like, wow, yeah, that other one, I love it. I'm like, yeah, me too. But I had to send you the one I spent months on because I had to get the bad out before I could get the good out.
I think that happens with a lot of us. I mean, it's like when Annie Lamott always says you have to give yourself permission to do a shitty first draft.
Yes. Yeah, you need to. You need to get that bad stuff out before you can get to the gold.
Yeah.
So
I want to ask you specifically about one character that you draw all the time, which is your dragon.
Rory!
Yes, talk to me about Rory.
Okay, so Rory is a puppet. He was given to my husband before he went to Afghanistan the first time. His sister and he always had this thing. He would get her fairies and she would get him dragons for Christmas, and they would constantly have this theme. And so before he went to Afghanistan, she got him Rory, and he puts his hand into the puppet thing and looks around and just goes roar, and that was it. The character was conceived, and from then on Rory was this living, breathing entity with a full personality, and it was great because he was living with roommates and he would set up these like traps where they would open the door and the dragon would come swinging at them, or they would pass out drunk and they'd wake up and Rory would be sitting on their pillow with a fork in one hand and a bottle of hot sauce in the other. And it just became this thing. And then when he went overseas the second time, he didn't take Rory with him, by the way, because the air in where he was in Afghanistan would have
Destroyed the puppy.
It would have gone into everything. I mean, when he came home, all of his clothes, you know, his sneakers tossed, his PlayStation tossed, everything tossed. So when he went over the second time, Rory stayed with me. We were married at that point. And I was going to a Sigler signing, and I knew that some Between the Lines Studios people were going to be there. And I said, well, you know what? I'm going to bring Rory, and then you'll be able to find me, because we'd already talked about Rory enough that people knew. And that made it really easy for people to find me. And then I started bringing him with me to cons, and then he had his own Twitter handle, and then he had his own Facebook page, and it became this whole thing. And then he started, he became part of my art that often I would come up with these really clever things to do. Like, I have drawn the Dread Pirate Rory. I actually did all of the Avengers as Rory.
I think I remember seeing that.
They've all sold too. Every single one.
Fantastic.
and the variants, Loki as well, and Daredevil. So Daredragon.
Oh, that's fantastic. I didn't know you did a Loki Rory. I'm jealous now.
Yes, I haven't posted it on the blog yet. I actually made that one while I was at Balticon. So I had sold all of them at Balticon, and while I was at Balticon, I was at the barbecue, and I did it during the barbecue. There's actually like a tiny piece of barbecue sauce on there somewhere, which just makes it authentic. And then
definitely.
And then Heather Welliver saw it, and she's like, I have to have it. I have to. I was like, okay. So that one went really fast. So I didn't really get, like, a full scan of it, but I did get a photograph, and I just haven't put it up on the blog yet. I've got so much art that I haven't put on the blog.
I bet.
It's a little sad. I have art from last Christmas I haven't put up on the blog. That's mostly because that particular one I painted it and I scanned it, but then I sent it off to somebody. It was part of a gift exchange. So I had painted somebody as the doctor.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
If you could solve one of the world's problems, big or small, what would it be?
Oh, there's so many problems I want to solve, like, you know, poverty, injustice, racism, sexism, all of these things. They're really big goals. But I think what I keep thinking about is I would like everyone to have proper mental health care. And And oh, wow. I feel like there are so many things going on in the world today that if people had mental health care, these things wouldn't be happening or they'd be better. I mean, we hear about these people going around shooting people up, and it's a mental issue. You know, these are almost always, you hear about these people have gone for help and been rejected. The Virginia State Virginia Tech shooter was denied services, and it just, it makes me cry. It makes me so sad that there are people out there screaming for help and they are being ignored, and then it ends up becoming this violent thing. And if we could remove the stigma of asking for mental health, that would also help us out tremendously, because so many people are scared of seeking help and scared of being seen as weak and scared of what it might mean to go for help, that they don't get the help that they need. And we all need it, you know. To me, mental health is more important than physical health.
Well, I think the one feeds the other. If your brain isn't happy, the rest of you isn't either.
You can't get fully physically healthy unless you are mentally healthy. I mean, you can be healthy in certain ways, and I'm not saying, people with mental health issues are physically unhealthy. But what I am saying is that your mental health definitely is a contributing factor to your physical health. And you can talk to doctors, and they will tell you that, you know, the best cancer surviving patients and the best patients are those that are getting the emotional and the mental needs that they need, as well as the physical treatment. And that your state of mind will definitely inform how your body is going to deal with things. Because your mind can make you sick, and your mind can help you get better. It's not going to fix everything, but it can make you a good vessel for treatment.
Absolutely. I think that's why it's also so important that so many celebrities are being open about their own mental health issues, because it destigmatizes it.
Yeah. And I have such a hard time when people turn, a celebrity into a joke when they're seeking medical treatment, when they go to rehab, you know, oh, let's make fun of the person who went to rehab. And it's like, no, let's not. Let's commend them. Because those that don't die, you know.
It takes so much courage for someone who isn't a celebrity to do it. How much more courage do you think it must take when everyone's watching you?
Exactly. And you know, it's not just, can I go get treatment, but people are going to make fun of me for admitting this problem. And I don't find it funny. I think it's a very serious issue. And it's something that is very near and dear to my heart. I've worked in group homes. I've worked in the field a little bit. I've worked in art therapy a little bit. But it's also affected me through those that I love. I've had my own, you know, issues myself. It's something that just can't be neglected. And so often, somebody has one thing, and I was actually just reading this on a friend of a friend's blog the other day. It's you've been diagnosed with one thing, so they ignore the fact that you could possibly have another thing.
Right.
And it's like, well, and I say this about autism so often. They'll say, well, they're autistic. Well, they are autistic, but maybe they also have something else. I have ADD, but I also have other things, you know. Someone could have bipolar, but they can also have other things. And you need to not just treat, but extend the idea that, okay, once you found one thing doesn't mean that you're done. And so often finding the right therapist can be important, because there's so many therapists that just don't match.
I think it's important to remember, especially for women who are usually not good at asking questions of medical personnel, mm-hmm. that even if it's through insurance, you are paying these people for a service, and you have the right to hire and fire your health professionals.
Absolutely. Yeah. Finding the right one is very important.
I interview doctors before I sign on their service,
which is awesome. My sister does that. And I tried to go to one of her doctors, when I was in the States, and unfortunately my insurance didn't cover her doctor, but her doctor was amazing. So now, everyone in my family has been looking for doctors, and I'm like, just go to her. She'll tell you. She's vetted everyone. And she does. She finds just the best doctors. I know up here, when I was in the East, when I was in New Brunswick, there was a doctor shortage. So I was on a list, and I lucked out and got an amazing doctor. I couldn't have like planned that better. But when I got here, I actually had a choice, and I went through all of the different websites looking at the reviews people said and tried to make up my own mind and tried to find somebody. I like doctors who are younger, because I feel that they're open to new treatment ideas and they are less prejudiced by, older medical ideas. And then I try to look for somebody who's just a little more open, a little more receptive. And then I went in and I found the doctor that sounded right. I went in, I met her. She was awesome. I was like, great, I'm good. But yeah, you're right. I mean, so many times we feel like we don't have a choice. And well, it's a doctor, so a doctor knows what they're talking about. You know what? Doctors make mistakes all the time. And if,
you know what else is I find really important to know?
Mm.
I used to do mortgages for a living, so I've seen everybody's credit. Doctors and lawyers do not necessarily have the best credit.
No, no.
Because they're arrogant.
Yeah.
They tend to be, I mean, they're not all arrogant. Most that I've dealt with are very nice people. But as a class, mm-hmm. they tend to be more arrogant than the average person.
Well, and they're
so
treated as if they're always right.
Right. So if there's like a paper that didn't get delivered, instead of just paying it, they're going to let it sit there until it becomes a thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, Kaiser doctors start at only $75,000 a year.
Wait, what?
The Kaiser Permanente medical thing?
Uh-huh.
Their GPs start at $75,000 a year.
Okay. I don't know what this is. I've never heard of this.
Oh, Kaiser is one of the largest HMOs in the U.S. It's mostly California.
Oh, okay. Well, I lived on the East Coast, so I didn't.
Oh, that's right. So you wouldn't know it. But yeah, Kaiser Permanente. We used to actually have a template for Kaiser doctors at one point.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I had so many issues with insurance because I worked for small businesses, and small businesses can't afford good insurance.
Yeah, well, it depends where you are and when and if they're connected to like trade organizations.
Yeah. So that was always an issue. I remember I had one job where I couldn't afford the insurance and to see the doctor. So I actually just took what I would spend on insurance and put it into a savings account and then used that to pay for my doctor when I needed to go. It was very sad.
Yeah, but at least you took steps so that you could do it if you had to. Some people can't even do that.
I was very fortunate in my situation. And I was very fortunate that I never had to dip into that to save my butt. There would have been times. That was,
I remember,
not a good financial time for me. it was very tricky. I what I was paying for to live. I mean, there were many times that I just didn't buy food and just got myself invited to people's houses. But I was fortunate that I had people that I could do that with.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
So obviously you've gone through some times that have been more challenging than others. When you have a really challenging time or you have a bad mood, how do you shake yourself out of it?
Oh, it can be tricky. when I'm like in a deep funk, you know, when I got the mean reds, sometimes I just need to shut off. I need to watch Netflix. I need to, get myself out of my head. I need to go for a walk. I need to, there's so many different things that I can do. Sometimes I'm just angry and if I take a shower, I'll be fine. But, other times I need to go for like a nice long walk. But if I'm in a perpetual funk, I know that I need to just start creating. And I need to do things. I know that there was a time when I was living in Nova Scotia and I was really getting into this deep funk and it was lasting for a while and I just wasn't feeling it. And my husband's like, you realize you haven't put up one single piece of artwork since you moved here. And we went around the house and we put up all the pictures and all the artwork and suddenly I was inspired again. And it was a lot of work to do all of that. People think, oh, just put up a couple of pictures. You don't understand. I have a lot of stuff to put up and it's a big deal. But no, I mean, just doing that, putting up the artwork and seeing, okay, these are my creations and seeing the faces of the people that I love. Really, it drew me out of that and it changed everything. So now I say that you're moved in if you've started to put up artwork.
I agree. Yeah. I've had battles with my husband in various houses that we've lived in about not wanting to put holes in the walls. And I'm like, you know what? We own it. Who cares?
See, we rent from the government, and that's always a concern. But I'm really good at repairing holes. Yeah, I'm really good at repairing holes. And while they used to insist, like when my husband was young, and he would go through a marching out because his dad was in the military too, they used to insist like every single hole was covered and you could see nothing, and his dad would like spackle things up and have to paint and all this other stuff. They don't care about that because they're like, we're just gonna have to paint anyway and we have to restore anyway. We really don't care. We just want the walls clean, we want them white, we want the floors clean, and you got to make sure that the tricky part is you got to wash down the windowsills and you got to clean out the vents. But really, if there's a hole and like the size of a pin or a nail, they don't care. And that's the truth.
Well, that's good. See, that's reasonable.
Yeah. And I've never had a landlord care about anything the size of a nail or under. It's just they don't want anything bigger than a dime, you know? That's when you cover it.
Well, yeah. So molly bolts are an issue.
yeah, molly bolts can be an issue. Sometimes you can just leave them there if they're like white in color. Oh, yeah. You can just leave them there and they don't really have a problem. But my favorite thing now is monkey hooks.
Do they actually work?
Yes, they do. I'm looking at artwork hanging off of a monkey hook right now. I've been having issues with things that are flat that don't have anything to grip on. But anything that needs to hang, the monkey hook is wonderful. What it is it just looks like a big hook, like the size of if you took your thumb and your pointer finger and made a C. And what it does, and then there's a little hooky bit, bent pit part for the picture at the end. What you do is you push it through the drywall and then it curves all the way up so that the weight is actually pressing on the back of the drywall, and it distributes it in such a way that you can hang your things without it pulling through the drywall, and it leaves just a little hole in the wall.
That's fantastic.
It's easy to put in. It's easy to take out. They are amazing.
You talked about the fact that you liked to read at lunch at certain jobs when you remembered to take lunch.
Yes.
So is there a book, movie, album, TV show, or song that is particularly meaningful to you?
Well, there's a lot, and I could go on ad nauseum over so many of them, but I'm going to talk about A Song of Ice and Fire.
Okay.
And many people know that as the books that Game of Thrones was based on. And for me, that has been such a connector. It has connected me to so many different people. One of the things was, my husband and I had met in a chat room, and a good friend of ours, we had met there. And our friend used to play a character named Jon Snow, had nothing to do with the character Jon Snow, but it was because of these books, and he kept telling us, you need to read these, you need to read these, you need to read these. Well, my husband picked up the book, and he started reading it. This was back when we were dating, and he said, oh my God, this is amazing, Nutty, you have to read this. And I was like, yeah, but the series isn't done. You know, the same excuses everybody has. You know, the series isn't done. And what happens if he doesn't finish? And I don't like reading and then having to wait because I don't reread books. Well, I finally got around and he bought me a Game of Thrones for Christmas one year, I think it was. And I tore through it and it was amazing. The thing that we tell people is, if you can get to the line, the things I do for love, and you don't like it, you don't have to read it. But once you get to that line, you are either going to love the series or just not be interested. And I was totally hooked. Now, I was hooked with the first Bran chapter, which most people don't like, but I loved it. So it was all-encompassing, all-engulfing. As a matter of fact, because I was reading those books in the break room, when we had our Secret Santa that year, someone had gotten me the next book in the series.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, when Storm of Swords came out, I got Storm of Swords in my gift exchange at work because they saw me reading the books. And It was fantastic. I loved it so much. So because of that, my husband and I have always had something to talk about. We've talked about it with our friend ad nauseum. And then, you know, I connected with a bunch of other people. Whenever you find out that somebody else has read this series that at the time nobody else had heard of, it was like finding out that you've met another Trekkie. You know, it's always something to talk about, always something to connect on. And, we used to, when we would go to bookstores, we would go and we would find his books, George Martin's books, and we would turn them face out so people would see them more regularly.
That's fantastic.
And this was in a day when, you know, you'd try to talk about the books and nobody had heard of it. Even though he had been a New York Times bestseller for these books, people still had no idea what we were talking about. And then the talk of the HBO show comes out, and my friend PG sends, you know, he I think it was on Skype, I'm not even sure, but he sends me a message and he's like, so I'm thinking about doing this show, and maybe it was email, I can't remember. I'm thinking of doing a podcast and I'd really like you to join us. We want, you know, some good expertise, yada yada, and we started doing a podcast about the show. And I think I'd still be as into the show as I am now, but I'm pretty sure that doing the podcast, it makes you hold on to things a lot more. There have definitely been things that have upset us, and when it does, we talk about it. But it brought me so much closer to those people, and I've been so grateful for that. And because of that, PG and I got really close the last few years of his life, and it was fantastic. And I've got this podcasting family that I would not have had it not been for these books that nobody had heard of.
Oh, that's really lovely. And do you have the cookbook?
I do. I do. I have A Feast of Ice and Fire. As a matter of fact, I used to follow the blog in at the crossroads before they put the book together. And I sent them pictures of my creations and my lemon cakes and things like that way back when.
I have done the beef and bacon pie.
And how is it?
Messy. Really, it's basically beef stew in a pie crust that the top crust is interlaced bacon. It's woven bacon. And I didn't have a tray big enough to do it, so we used the bottom of the broiler pan, which was good because it had a lip. But yeah, it's really messy to clean up that much bacon.
Yeah, yeah.
But the beet recipe, there's a beet recipe where they have you wrap them in olive in foil and like roast them and then slice them and saute. That has become my standard beet recipe.
I love beets. I never had beets until Mark the Encaffeinated One served them to me, and I was like, I never had beets before. And then I was like, why does everyone talk about these like they're like icky vegetables? They're candy.
No, they're like candy. Yams and beets are nature's candy.
They are total. They're candier than yams, though. They are candy.
Oh, totally. And you know what else? The juice makes the best dye.
Yes, it is. It is very, very dye-like.
I learned that you can actually eat beet greens in salad, and I had never known that before.
I think I have had those, actually.
I use them as garnish a lot because they're really pretty.
Yes, they are. You were talking about bacon, and one of the things I wanted to mention was we've started making bacon in a new way. Friends showed us, the wife of the host of Epic, another podcast I've been on. What you do is when you bake your bacon, okay, and you sprinkle corn flour on top of the bacon. Ooh. And you put it in the oven. And what the corn flour does is it absorbs a lot of grease. So your bacon doesn't curl, but it's crispy.
So I should try that the next time I make a crust for beef and bacon pie.
It gives you the right amount of crisp without it being burnt. You know, it's crispy, but it's also got enough chewy for you to get the full bacon flavor. It's fantastic.
I don't know why everyone has been baking their bacon for years, even without corn flour, because it is so much easier and less messy than a frying pan.
Oh, it really is. It really is.
And you can do it like all at once and it doesn't get cold.
I have like a jar that I keep all the bacon fat in afterwards. And I keep thinking like I should be able to make a bacon candle out of that.
That would be awesome. Could you imagine? It would torture people.
It would. Well, I do know that the hosts of Epic, what they do with their bacon grease is they have a bonfire in their yard, and they'll put the grease into the bonfire, and it smells like bacon.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's delightfully evil.
It is. It's horrible, but it's fun.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, they've got a really good setup there. So
bacon torches could be a thing too.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, that'd be crazy. So when the first episode of Game of Thrones aired, I made a whole feast. I had already devised my own lemon cakes recipe.
Really?
Oh yes. It's I use lemon. It's like a lemon cake. You know, like a standard cake, and then I fill it with lemon pie filling, and then I just put some powdered sugar over top.
I use lemon curd.
Nice.
I go to the British food stall, and I buy or World Market, because it's closer and cheaper. And I use lemon curd because it's slightly less sweet.
Sounds delicious. Perfect. If I could get my hands on it, I would totally do that. And then I made rabbit.
You live in Canada and you can't get lemon curd?
I know, right? Isn't that crazy? I can get all the Cadbury stuff.
We could trade.
Yeah. And then I made a rabbit. I made a braised rabbit for the meal and, I can't remember. I made like a wild mushroom couscous, and yeah, it was like a whole big feast. I've got pictures of it on my Flickr, and I was like really into it, and it was awesome.
I did their lamb recipe, which was really good. I love that cookbook. I love it. It's perfect for like Twelfth Night or anything where you want to go remotely medieval.
I love just reading it.
I love that they explain, like, the whole first chapter before you get to the recipes where it talks about what was used then, like, if you were looking at medieval cooking, which is the nearest equivalent, and how you can find a contemporary version. And we have a store here in Texas called Central Market that is – it's a Heb store, so it's employee-owned.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, like, the Heb version of Whole Foods. So it's a natural food store, but it's employee-owned.
Mm.
And so much of their stuff is locally sourced, which is really awesome. But they have a spice section that could be an entire store. They have an olive oil bar. They have a salt bar. It's ridiculous.
Oh, my God. Don't let me go in there. I'll spend all my money.
Oh, please. We go there. We actually eat breakfast in their cafe. And then we shop.
That's smart. Better than doing it hungry, right?
Yeah, and their cafe, I mean, they sell everything by volume, not by, like, each.
Mm-hmm.
So you can like fill a tray with scrambled eggs, and then you just pay based on the weight of your scrambled eggs.
Lovely.
It's great. And then they have an espresso bar right there, because of course they do. It's lovely. But yeah, they have all of the funky, obscure spices.
I like to look at cookbooks, not to really follow the recipes, but to get ideas. Because I find a lot of the cookbooks, a lot of stuff that they have you do is so time consuming. And then I actually saw this on that Gordon Ramsay show where he goes in and he fixes the kitchens.
I know what you mean, but I don't know the name of it.
Anyway, the nice one where you get to see nice Gordon Ramsay.
Yes.
And somebody had his cookbooks, and he's like, but I've got your cookbooks. And he's like, these are not for a restaurant. These are for people to make it at home. So they spend time on food, so they feel like they've done something important. You're in a restaurant. You need to get it out within 10 minutes. You don't have time to follow a cookbook. And I just thought that was hysterical, because that's how I've always felt. I've always felt like cookbooks, they're so time consuming, and I just don't have time for that. Like, people talk about slow cookers, and I'm like, no, pressure cookers. I'm not about cooking it slowly. I want to cook it fast.
I like my slow cooker for things where I want to throw something in frozen at the beginning of the day and just let it simmer.
I started finally using the slow cooker. What I would do is I would put food in, and I would go to Aikido, because Aikido is like 3 hours often, at least. And so it would cook for 3 hours, and I'd come home, and it would be all tasty.
See, that's perfect. I make meatloaf in my crock pot.
What was that last thing you said?
I make meatloaf in my crock pot.
Oh, weird.
It comes out like steamed, like really dense, and I kind of really like it.
Oh, okay.
But you have to use really lean beef or else it's gross.
Yeah. I only eat my mom's meatloaf, basically. I find all other, and when I say my mom's meatloaf, it means that I can cook it as well. It's just that recipe. I find most meatloaf to be unflavorful, and it's what did you do to this wonderful meat? You could have done so many other wonderful things to it. I find sad food sad. It hurts me. I have all respect for animals, but I am I'm a huge carnivore. And the way that I respect an animal is that I make sure that when I cook it, I make something delicious. And if it doesn't taste good, I feel bad. And I hate wasting food because I feel like it's dishonorable.
I my meatloaf recipe is basically the same as my meatball recipe with just a couple of minor variations.
Nice.
So it's actually pretty flavorful.
Yeah.
And then I play with it from time to time when I feel like it. Is there a person in your life who has been a particular influence on you?
There have been many people who have been particular influences on me. I have such a hard time with, like, is there a one anything? But
top three.
Jeez, that's hard too.
Or not top, but I will
mention a few. I will say that my mother has had a huge influence in me because while I didn't realize it, I grew up in a very feminist household, which is wonderful. My father was a merchant marine, so he was gone half the time. And when I mean gone, I mean he was away on ship. Yeah. So when he was home, but when he was gone, he was gone. So essentially my mother was a single mom, even though she had a husband. She was in charge of everything. She was in charge of the finances. She was in charge of the house. She was in charge of the vehicles. She was in charge of discipline. She did everything and was basically a superwoman. And she has always been a positive influence on my life. When my mother had, I am the seventh of nine kids. So that's a lot of kids. So on top of doing this all alone, it's been a lot of kids. And she was able to instill in us the morals that she felt were important. She was able to raise educated, good people. I will say that everyone in my family, they are all really good people. I mean, we may have our flaws, but when it comes down to it, we are charitable, kind people. I mean, my mom was out at Fire Island last week I went down to visit her, but the week before she was out there and she saw this woman who had teenagers and they were on just a little like motorboat and they had come across and they had planned to camp, but they were getting eaten by all of these bugs. And they read on the website that there was a restaurant and a snack bar. So they didn't pack food. They just packed snacks. They thought they'd eat at the restaurant the whole time. The website did not inform them that the restaurant is only open on the weekends and it's not open all day. It's only open for dinner. So they had nothing. So my mom went back to her boat and she gave them these really nice custom hamburgers and some bread to put them on and some cat. She gave them groceries so that they had something to eat and took care of them until they could get ready for the next day and leave and go and get provisions. So, but that's just like second nature in my family. Like that's the kind of people that we are. We will just, we see somebody in need, we will help them out.
That's fantastic.
And so all of my siblings are like that. And, I will say that every single one of them, save for myself, are parents now. And most of them, that's what they've wanted to be their entire life. So my family is filled with men and women that just wanted to be parents. And when they became parents, they became super, super happy. And that's pretty amazing.
I think that's really lovely of the whole family of nurturers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They're wonderful. And, Then her sister is also a very positive influence in my life. My aunt, I actually wanted to get her on the show, but when we met up, when I was in New York, we just ended up, just talking and spending time together and me not wanting to stop that for recording. But she has put together the youth center in her neighborhood. She is on the community council. She has always pushed forward things in her community to make her community a better community. And the community she's in has always been on the cusp of a struggling community. You know, I grew up in a very nice suburban neighborhood comparatively. It was economically diverse. It was ethnically diverse. It was diverse in all, you know, religion, everything. It was wonderful. But where my aunt comes from, it was a lot more of a struggling community, and she has always tried to make it better. And she's never gotten into like politics of, you know, election and officials, but it's always been volunteering her time to push forward her community and make it a better community. I think she's been given the Martin Luther King Award like twice now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, they're constantly giving her awards. She doesn't count them. She just half the time she tries to turn them down and says, no, give somebody else the limelight. Like, that is just the kind of person that she is. And so she's actually one of my mentors, like one of my official mentors. When I was working on the board of a radio station, and I needed to figure out directions to go, we would sit down and we would have a conversation and a mentor conversation. And so she has definitely been a very positive influence in me. So many of my influences are females, because I have met so many amazing females and I look to them for guidance, and it's great. And these are all women that are not the, some people, and I say it this way on purpose. Some people feel that in order to be heard, they need to be commanding, they need to be mean, and they need to push people around. And real leadership are people that set an example by doing. And these are the people that I pay attention to. And so these are my huge influences.
If you could have dinner with one historical figure, celebrity, or fictional character, who would you choose?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I think it would have to be Kurt Vonnegut. I think Kurt Vonnegut would be a lot of fun. For a while I thought he had passed away, and then I found out he was still alive when he wrote Man Without a Country, and I was like, what? Are you kidding? So I tried to see if I could get to a book signing or something and meet him, and I never could. And then he did pass away, and so that was sad, but I always thought that he would be an interesting person to have a conversation with, because I love his writing. And if you've read Man Without a Country, you can see he's so tempered in the way that he views things. Like, he's not extreme in any way. And I think that that's important. Like, you need to be able to have balance.
I have always really loved the way he uses language and the way he is a chameleon with language.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of my favorite things is in Man Without a Country, he says, you know, never, ever use semicolons. Never. And then later on in the book, he uses a semicolon. And then he writes right in there, yes, you see what I did there? I used a semicolon. That's important too. Always break the rules. And I just thought that was fantastic and just so perfect.
Is there any charity or cause you feel particularly strongly about?
There are so many that I feel particularly strong about. I do feel that it's important to make sure you know what you're donating towards. Many charities sound really good, but they put a lot more money into administrative costs. And a lot of times the more popular charity is not a great charity. I am very big with autism charities, but I can say this because this is not my work name. I am very much against Autism Speaks. Autism Speaks is the most known charity, and they have such a hold on other charities that if you don't support them, you will be blacklisted from getting any money or anything. Autism Speaks wants to cure autism. They see it as a disease. They see it as something is wrong with these people, which is not the case. They're just not
differently wired.
Yeah, they're not neurotypical. They're neuroatypical. And they are more about making parents' lives easier. They do not have anyone with autism on their board or any of their higher ups. No, no one.
I knew they had issues, but I didn't know they didn't have.
On top of that, they have hired people and not given them allowances for having autistic children, and not been understanding about it. There have been so many issues. So if you want to support the cause of autism, because yes, there are lots of trials and tribulations that people on the spectrum experience, and they definitely need support. Support is so important. Look for local charities. Look for charities that are doing more on a smaller scale, and look for people that actually have people on the spectrum working with them. You will always find, you know, having somebody on the spectrum on their board is very important. Having parents are important, but also having people actually there doing the work. And one of my clients, which I'm not going to mention name because I do not use my work name, but I have been so happy because one of their main staff is on the spectrum, and she has been doing a phenomenal job and just kicking butt and taking names. And then their intern that they get in the summer is on the spectrum, and she has also been amazing. And it's just really great to see. You can really see a difference when there's people on the spectrum working for an autistic charity. It affects everything that they do, and they do things in a way to support that community better. And that is the case for anything. If you want to support a charity that is working for the disabled, make sure that they employ disabled. If you are wanting to support somebody that is helping the homeless, make sure that they're employing the homeless, or people who have been homeless are on their board. You need somebody who has been in the community, who has been affected, to be a part of it. Otherwise, they do not treat that community properly. So that's my big thing, is if you are interested in donating, make sure you know what you're donating towards. And sometimes these umbrella corporations or charities can be really helpful, but because they dole it out to other people, but so often they spend so much money on legal, they spend so much money on protecting their brand. There's a particular charity that sounds like a really great charity, and they actually spend more money on lawsuits going after other charities that sound like them than actually giving it to the people they say they serve. They just really look at what they're doing, and then you'll be able to know if what you're doing, what you're giving towards, is what you agree with.
Is there a piece of wisdom or advice, it doesn't have to be pithy, that you've given or received that you would like to share?
Communicate. The key to everything is communication. When you are upset with another person, communicate with them, because often it's not as bad as you think it is. And if you can communicate and be open to communication, so you need to be open to having your ideas change. Then if you can communicate, you can do almost anything.
I'm going to ask you now where you can be found on the net, in media, etc. And then I'm going to thank you for being here.
You can find links to everything that I do at nimlas.org, NIMLAS.org. You can find me on Twitter, it's Nuke Joss. You can find me on Facebook. You can find my podcast, Nutty Bites, which is also doing the Dog Days of Podcasting. You can find Beyond the Wall, which is a Game of Thrones podcast. You can find Epic, which is another geeky podcast. Run for Your Life, which is a rockabilly podcast that I used to be on, but I am no longer on. You can find all of those things at nimlas.org. I mean, really, you can stalk me. It's pretty easy.
Bath to Mermaid is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartell and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 International License. Music for this episode was provided by Mebio's Music Alley, a great resource for PodSafe music. Visit them at music.mebio.com. The opening song is Soap in a Bathtub by Stony. The closing song is You Can Use My Bathtub by Little Tom. The Bathtub Mermaid is produced and recorded using Boss Jock and Audacity. You can contact me by leaving a comment at the website, www.bathtubmermaid.com, by finding me on Twitter, at Meliss, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E, or by sending an email to Meliss, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E, at starfleet.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, never let your bathwater get too cold. Still it.
shows. But you can use my bathtub. Understand, you can use my bathtub. Yes, you can.